B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comments. It's Wednesday, February 19th, 2020. And tonight, former New York mayor and billionaire Mike Bloomberg makes his presidential debate debut in Las Vegas. And he's placed about a $400 million bet so far that he can buy the Democratic nomination and then buy his way into the White House in November. And I predict, and I don't generally make a lot of predictions, that Bloomberg's presence on the stage tonight is going to be a huge gift to Bernie Sanders. Because absent Bloomberg and his millions and the millions of targets that he carries in his political baggage, if Bloomy weren't on the stage tonight, all the guns would be trained on Bernie Sanders, because the polls show that he is separating from the rest of the pack and becoming the front runner. And as this takes place, Bloomberg will be the target of all of the criticism, both from debate moderators — it's the NBC, not the MSNBC team — but also from fellow candidates. And sure, there'll be swipes at Bernie for socialism and Medicare for all, but he has solid polling. And all he has to do is be Bernie and avoid making any big mistake tonight. And I think he's going to come out very well. Now, I also think that Bloomberg is unknown to most Americans. They've just seen his TV commercials, where he only speaks for a soundbite here and there, and he fawns over Obama. The footage that Bloomberg is using from Obama is highly deceptive, and Obama should have put a stop to it already. But other candidates also use footage and still photographs of them with the most recent Democratic president. And I'm looking at some handicapping here from the New York Times. In a subhead, they list as the forgotten front runner. They say he received the most votes in the first two states and is considered a favorite in Nevada. Yet Sanders somehow does not enter the debate as the likeliest target of his rivals. Why? Because while carrying about one quarter of the vote so far, his rivals see their clearest path to the nomination as consolidating the other 75%. And Bloomberg is what stands between, say, Amy Klobuchar or Elizabeth Warren or Pete Buttigieg, and breaking through to those moderate voters that so many of the candidates are chasing. So the latest Washington Post ABC poll is somewhat stunning, because it shows that as Joe Biden has dropped by half, Bernie Sanders has jumped, showing his lead at 32%, up 9 points since January. Biden is, he had the 32% in January. It's cut by half, 16%. Bloomberg has bought a 14% national standing, up from 8% in January. No change for Elizabeth Warren. She is stuck at 12%. Buttigieg, despite his recent strong performances in Iowa and New Hampshire, and they were strong, still runs fifth at 8%. That's a 3-point gain from a month ago. And Klobuchar has jumped from 3 to 7%, which is a significant increase, but it doesn't put her in the top tier of the Democratic candidates. So here is what is fascinating when you dig into the deeper parts of this poll. 58 to 38%, Democrats say they'd rather nominate a candidate who can defeat Trump as compared to one who agrees with them on major issues. And a month ago, 38% of Democratic-leaning adults said that Biden was the one who has the best chance of defeating Trump. That has been cut in half too, 38 to 19%. But in this new poll, despite the constant drumbeat from the media and the catcalls and attacks from the so-called moderate corporate Democrats and the Democratic National Committee, Sanders is now seen as the most electable, cited by 30% of Democratic leaners as best situated to beat Trump. His second is Bloomberg at 18%, and no other Democrat is ranked above 10%. So Biden's loss is the gain of Bernie Sanders. He's also seen a big jump in support among voters under age 50, and he now has half of that vote under age 50. And it's time for me to say, okay, boomers, get over your dreams about Hillary Clinton's entitlement. Put aside your fantasies that Mike Bloomberg is racing in to save the day like Mighty Mouse. And understand that Bernie Sanders has popular support and can beat Donald Trump. Sanders holds a 3-to-1 lead over his rivals among the voters under age 50. Here's more. 62% of Democratic-leaning adults say that Sanders is about right ideologically, 20 points higher than the share who said the same thing in New Hampshire exit polls. Let me repeat that. 62% of Democrats say that Sanders is about right on ideology. He's not too far left. He's not scary socialist. 72% of these people polled, these Democrats, say they believe that Sanders would defeat Trump. So I think that is fascinating because it means that a lot of people are tuning out Rachel Maddow, Chris Matthews, and these voices who tell them on a daily basis that Sanders is wrong, he's too far left, he's dangerous, he blah, blah, blah. Now, this is also mirrored here in California, where Sanders has jumped into the lead with 32% of likely Democratic primary voters. And the rest of the gang, Biden, Warren, Buttigieg, and Bloomberg, are locked in a statistical tie for second in the range of 14%. Klobuchar at 5%. Tom Steyer, the California businessman and climate change activist, is polling only 3% in his home state. Sanders is seen as the candidate with the best chance of defeating Trump, 34%. Bloomberg and Biden, half of that, 16%. Buttigieg has seen his California support double from 6% in January to 12% in the latest survey, and that's where we see Bloomberg with his TV campaign. He's at 12%. And Mark Baldessari, the pollster who took this for the Public Policy Institute of California, he is a highly regarded public opinion expert. Sanders' numbers were pulled right from Biden and Warren, but Bloomberg also took away some of their support. In Sunday's New York Times, this is a piece I didn't get to yesterday, Ross Douthat, who is a fairly centrist, Democratic, moderate, he supported Clinton in 2016. He writes about the Bloomberg temptation. Describing the former mayor, he has the record of a deficit and foreign policy hawk, the soul of a Wall Street centrist, a history of racial and religious profiling and sexist misbehavior. More than any other contender, his nomination would pull the party back toward where it stood before the rise of Bernie Sanders and Black Lives Matter and Me Too, and root liberalism once more in a professional class interest and a Washington Wall Street mind meld. These are good reasons to assume that he can't be the nominee, and excellent reasons for social progressives and socialists alike to want to beat him. The only way they will fail is if Bloomberg succeeds in casting himself as the unusual answer to an unusual incumbent, combining the Democratic fear of a Trump second term, his own reputation for effective management, and the promise of spending his fortune to crush Trump. But Democrats considering this sales pitch should be very clear on what a Bloomberg presidency would mean. While he doesn't have Trump's flagrant vices or his bald disdain for norms and rules and legal niceties, a Bloomberg presidency will feel less institutionally threatening, less constitutionally perilous than the ongoing wildness of the Trump era. However, feelings can be deceiving. Trump's authoritarian tendencies are naked on his Twitter feed, but Bloomberg's imperial instincts, his indifference to limits on his power, are a conspicuous feature of his career. Trump jokes about running for a third term, Bloomberg actually managed it. Trump tries to bully the FBI and undermine civil liberties. Bloomberg ran New York as a miniature surveillance state. Trump has cowed the Republican Party with celebrity and bombast. Bloomberg has spent his political career buying organizations and politicians who otherwise might impede him. Trump blusters and bullies the press. Bloomberg literally owns a major media organization. I think those are very well-stated considerations. And as if on cue, the daily offensive quote from Mike Bloomberg that has surfaced today takes on trans people. And this is not an ancient comment. This is a video from last year, 2019. As Bloomberg described transgender people as he, she, or it and some guy in a dress. And he said, you can understand when you look at the Democratic Party, they are so far left that 2 years ago there was nobody on their side who would take these positions. And today virtually all the candidates for president of the Democratic Party are so progressive. I don't know what progressive means, brags Bloomy. If your conversation during a presidential election is about some guy wearing a dress and whether he, she, or it can go to the locker room with their daughter, that's not a winning formula for most people. Now, his campaign just waves this away, pointing you back to ancient history that in 2002, during his first year as mayor, Bloomberg signed a sweeping transgender civil rights bill into law. Well, it shows just how insincere he is if 17 years later he is still talking trash about trans people. Interesting piece published at The Atlantic today under the byline of Edward Isaac Dovier. And while he restates some of the same objections and criticisms of Bernie Sanders, he points out that Sanders confronted Barack Obama when Obama was ready to make his grand bargain that would cut Social Security benefits. In 2013, Sanders laid into Obama in a private meeting held with Democratic senators, saying that the president was selling out to Republicans over Social Security. And it's described as a testy exchange, where Obama said, I don't need any lectures. Nevertheless, Sanders was unbowed, and he was described as unloading on Obama in ways that made fellow senators cringe a little bit. But ultimately, Sanders prevailed. And Obama backed down and withdrew his grand bargain, which would, in fact, have cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid benefits. And there was also a discussion that originated when Bernie appeared on Tom Hartman's radio show in July of 2011, and he took a call from someone who was critical of Obama. And that led him to briefly consider challenging Obama in the 2012 presidential primaries, which led to deep consternation by Senate leader at the time, Harry Reid, and some interventions from Obama staffers. But hearing this only makes me more respectful of Bernie Sanders and his unflinching loyalty to average Americans and to the New Deal of FDR. Liza Featherstone, writing at Jacobin Mag today, says the attacks on Sanders supporters are going from ridiculous to the deranged. She opens with this: Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg, two unelectable candidates, apparently trying their best to outdo each other in alienating progressive voters, have recently tarred activists trying to make America a better place as dark money or super PACs. And she goes on to list some of the recent attacks against Sanders. That Mayor Pete, who tried to get the endorsement of the Sunrise Movement, didn't get it, and then described it as a political action committee, suggested that they're running dark money. And Elizabeth Warren claims that some $20,000 that National Nurses United has put into a political action committee in support of Sanders, that is dark money. Now, we know where that money came from, National Nurses United. Full disclosure, I've done some work for the National Nurses Union. They're very politically committed. and they put their money behind the candidates who support their policies. But this is not dark money at all. It's right out there in the open. And she writes, in all the hubbub over online harassment by so-called Bernie bros, some key facts get lost. One is that many of Sanders' most pugilistic and verbally merciless supporters, including some that have been asked by the campaign to tone it down, are women, making Bernie broism the latest field of endeavor in which the achievements of women are systematically overlooked. And we have a case of a woman who wants us to believe that she is a victim of Bernie bros and had to resign from her position as the treasurer of Pennsylvania Young Democrats. Her name is Lindy Lee, and she was apparently squeezed out by the president of Young Democrats after they were unable to communicate with her. Lindy Lee is a proud supporter of Joe Biden and has used her social media to trash Bernie Sanders recently, calling him a self-hating Jew and posting a picture of his visit to Moscow in the 1980s and suggesting that he is some kind of a communist. And as a result, the political leaders of the Young Democrats asked her to resign, not Bernie bros, but that's who she is blaming it on. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has done a good job. Reporter Robin Anderson has been monitoring NPR. And their bias against Sanders is very clear. She focuses on All Things Considered anchor Mara Liasson and quotes her in a number of places, claiming the main issue for the Democratic Party is electability, asserting that Democrats are confused for good reason because Trump remains an existential threat, and not only are none of the candidates a sure thing, none even seem likely to defeat Trump. Now, I just cited all of the recent polling data that contradicts that, but NPR, which has access to all of the polling data that I do, chose not to reflect that clear data point. The article quotes Liasson from an episode where she talked about the huge vulnerabilities the Democratic presidential candidates have for Trump to exploit. No mention made of the mammoth negatives that Democrats have to use against Trump. Instead, one of the most feared vulnerabilities is that Bernie Sanders is a socialist. And the FAIR article cites Data for Progress, where they conducted a poll and they asked three different questions. The first version mentioned no affiliation. The second identified the candidate by party. And the third sounded like this. If the U.S. presidential election were held today, who would you vote for? If the candidates were Democrat Bernie Sanders, who wants to tax the billionaire class to help the working class, and Republican Donald Trump, who says Sanders is a socialist who supports a government takeover of health care and open borders. In all three scenarios, Sanders won. He actually did slightly better when identified as a socialist as opposed to just being tagged as a Democrat. So we have a lot of urban legends and provable falsehoods that are being trotted out repeatedly on NPR. And this is supposed to be the network that we can rely on, right? For no partisanship and no political bias. Just pro-corporate bias, I guess. Want to recommend Caitlin Johnstone's latest, published today at consortiumnews.com. And the bonus is there is embedded a video of a statement she made to a recent public event. And you get to hear Caitlin Johnstone speak. And as you may know, through Joe Lauria, the editor at Consortium News, I requested an interview with Caitlin Johnstone, who I think is a brilliant commentator, and she declined, saying that it would wobble her thing. So I recommend that you read her piece. She basically says the reason that Bernie bros are being tagged and assaulted and demonized is that they are effective. They know how to use social media. And while some of them do cross a line into aggressive and snarky commentary, she said this is the people, it's an example of the people seizing the media platform and not backing down. Pete Buttigieg is firing back against homophobic attacks from Rush Limbaugh, and they've been embraced by Donald Trump. Rush says that Trump called him and explicitly said, "Don't back down." When you criticized Pete Buttigieg for kissing his husband on stage, it made a lot of conservatives feel really icky. And I'm glad that Pete is piping up. I do support him as a candidate, not my choice to vote for. But I'm glad that a gay man who identifies as a soldier, as a Christian, as a moderate, is running for president, and I hope that it will help normalize things in the long term. And so I deplore the attacks on his sexual identity, and I'm glad that he is not taking it and is pushing back. I was away on vacation when Limbaugh announced his stage 4 cancer diagnosis, and this is the first real opportunity I've taken to comment on it. As you may know, back in the 1990s, I was a host on KNBR in San Francisco, and I had the dubious distinction of following the Rush Limbaugh program every day. I also am one of the few lefty talk show hosts in the country who ever spent an hour talking to Rush Limbaugh live on radio. That's because in the early days he was less guarded, and once he got big ratings and million-dollar contracts, he put himself into a bubble and then swallowed a lot of OxyContin that led to his deafness. And he doesn't engage with critics or those who disagree with him in any way, shape, or form today. So I want to say that as a human being, I wish Limbaugh the best with his diagnosis. I do not wish that he suffer and die in some cruel fashion. That's just not who I am. But it's laughable. The way Trump staged his award of the National Medal of Honor to Limbaugh during the State of the Union message, making him just another part of the Trump circus. And when I spent that hour with Limbaugh during the commercial breaks, it was very clear that his whole shtick is an act. He told me that he's going to ride it all the way, and he has. He's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and he's made it by attacking those among us who have the least capability to defend themselves. And just for fun, I went to the archives and dug out a clip of my radio encounter with Rush Limbaugh, and here's an excerpt for you.
I look at my show as an entertainment forum for people, and I screen calls to find the best call. You know what the main, in my philosophy, you know what the purpose of a good call is on my show? It's to make me look good. I will tell you flat out, this show is not about what anybody else but me thinks. Mm-hmm. I'm not trying to discover what America thinks because it's impossible. There's no talk show host in the world who can tell you what his community or his neighborhood thinks based on what happens on his show. And so I'm not even laboring under that misconception. Calls are there to make me look good, to bring up interesting things. There's no public service aspect. There's no First Amendment aspect that I care about regarding it. And we're not looking for people who agree. In fact, we strive for people who disagree.
That's not true.
We'll talk more about that as we continue.
I had to take a break, so I had to cut him off. Anyway, Limbaugh is who he is. And it is actually sad to see how popular he is, how he has paved the way for Trump as a liar in chief. He's done a lot of damage to this country and in no way deserves a national honor. By the way, yesterday Bernie Sanders' spokesperson went on CNN, and I guess the issue came up last night in a town hall that I didn't watch on CNN featuring Bernie Sanders. But his national press secretary, Breonna Joy Gray, had suggested that questions about Sanders' health were unfair, and she said that he was being held to a different standard than Bloomberg. And she said that back in 2000, Bloomberg had stents inserted in his heart. But she incorrectly said that he has had heart attacks in the past, and apparently that is not true. Now, I don't agree with Bernie Sanders that he has given us enough information about his health. And I think that he needs to modify that position. He's saying that he's been forthcoming and nobody needs to know more. And I think that at his age, his health is a concern, and that he should not be seen as trying to withhold information. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Stu Russell, Brian Mazzi, Andrew Rush, and Aidan McAleer. They each chip in $5 or $10 a month to keep this operation going. And I welcome your support as well. All you have to do is visit peterbcollins.com, click on menu, click on become a subscriber. You'll hit the sign up page and you can choose a level of support that's comfortable for you. And if you want to avoid PayPal, I don't blame you. You can address your correspondence to my P.O. Box, number 150-660, San Rafael, California, 94915. And today, my subscribers get first grab on a new podcast about gerrymandering. In this interview, I talk once again with David Daley, the author of the book about gerrymandering called Rat Fucked, Why Your Vote Doesn't Count. And Daley has reviewed the massive files of Thomas Hoeffler. He was the Republican consultant and guru who masterminded many of the redistricting schemes since the 2010 census, many of which were intentionally aimed at disenfranchising minorities. Yes, they had a racial component. And the details of the data that Hoeffler collected on voters, it's just stunning. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with David Daley.
Well, Greensboro, North Carolina, is a majority black city, but it is represented in Congress by two of the most conservative members of the U.S. House. And one of the reasons for that is that Republicans there diluted the votes of the citizens of Greensboro by cracking it in half and splitting those votes across two different congressional districts so that there wouldn't quite be enough black voters in either one to elect a Democrat. So what Hoeffler did, one of his lines, I believe it's Laurel Street, and I've gone down there and I've actually walked this campus and seen this. And what they did was they put seven of the dorms at North Carolina A&T, the oldest historically black university in the nation, in one district and six in the other. And that just perfectly scattered those voters in such a way that you would end up with two Republican members. And in North Carolina, the politicians there have said, oh, we didn't know what we were doing there. That was just an accident. It's a coincidence. Oh, it just happens to be a precinct boundary. Except what you find in Hoeffler's files are these giant databases that show, you know, not only the racial makeup and the voting patterns and the specific addresses of tens of thousands of college students in North Carolina, but you see whether or not they had a driver's license that matched their college address, because North Carolina had gone and passed this really intense voter ID bill that was designed specifically to disenfranchise black voters in the state by mandating the kind of identification that they knew most black voters in the state did not have.
That's author and journalist David Daley. You can hear the full interview about Tom Hoeffler and gerrymandering available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, iTunes, TuneIn, Spreaker, and Stitcher. Well, last week when Bill Barr publicly said that he didn't want to hear any more tweets from Trump about the Justice Department, about the Roger Stone case, well, Trump has persisted. And this could be more theater, or maybe, can we hope devilishly that he's serious? Bill Barr has told friends that he might quit if Trump doesn't stop his damn tweeting. Now, this comes from leaks out of the Justice Department. But reportedly, Barr has told close friends he's considering quitting because Trump will not stop tweeting about Justice Department cases. Now, Trump is claiming that he is the top law enforcement officer in the country, even when it comes to investigations of himself and his cronies. He really doesn't get it. And today, he's been publishing retweets from Congressman Lee Zeldin, a Trump loyalist, and from Tom Fitton at Judicial Watch, a total Trump outfit. And they're calling for Bill Barr to clean up the Justice Department. Now, what that means is they want to get rid of people who aren't loyal to Trump. They don't want to stop the framing of Muslim Americans or African Americans for crimes that were set up by FBI paid informants. They don't want to deal with the true injustices of our system. They just want to fix it so that Trump can protect his cronies and himself and instruct his attorney general to act like Roy Cohn. Yesterday, I reported that Eddie DeBartolo, the former owner of the San Francisco 49ers, had received a pardon from Trump. Well, there's a whole rogues gallery going along with DeBartolo. Bernie Kerik, who was he was Mayor Giuliani's driver. And he was such a toady that he ultimately became New York police commissioner before, in an attempt to become Homeland Security director, he was exposed as a fraud and a guy who was illegally benefiting from his position. Also, Rod Blagojevich, the former Democratic governor of Illinois who tried to sell Obama's Senate seat to the highest bidder. Well, he had a friendship with Trump because he appeared on Trump's apprentice show shortly before he went to federal prison. In general, this bleeding heart liberal loves to see people, anybody, released from prison or pardoned for previous crimes. But this list of well-connected white guys, including Mike Milken and David Safavian, he was a crony of Jack Abramoff. And Safavian set up the cruise ship deal that Abramoff was involved in. He helped with the exploitation of Native American tribes in Alabama and Mississippi. And he already served his time, but he received a pardon from Trump. Now, most people believe this is paving the way for a pardon of Roger Stone and maybe all of Trump's cronies who have been convicted, some of whom are still in federal prison. We shall see. Trump, he said that he hasn't given it any thought. And, of course, like so much that comes out of Trump's mouth, that is an apparent lie. And regarding DeBartolo, the best commentary that I've heard about his pardon and the way 49er great wide receiver Jerry Rice lobbied Trump for it, well, a sports writer named Al Sarasevic at the San Francisco Chronicle doesn't cover politics. But boy, he does a good job of speculating just why Trump did it. I've linked to his sports page piece, and you can read it at your convenience. Just visit the show file at peterbcollins.com. Now, speaking of presidential pardons, a claim was made in court in London yesterday related to Julian Assange. They are getting ready for his extradition to the United States hearing. It's a lengthy process that will run through May. But Assange's lawyer referred to evidence alleging that former Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, who did visit Assange at the Ecuador embassy in London in August of 2017, dangled the possibility of a presidential pardon if Assange would flatly state that Russia had nothing to do with the DNC leaks. Now, we can believe that Assange received the dangle. And he did make statements that it was not a state actor, but he has never explicitly said it wasn't Russia. So the White House, in true form, now says the president barely knows Dana Rohrabacher, other than that he's an ex-congressman. He's never spoken to him on this subject or almost any subject. Well, that's not true, because we know there were several White House visits by Rohrabacher, and we know that John Kelly, the chief of staff, knew about his plan to meet with Assange. So, who you want to believe on that one? Chelsea Manning, who remains locked up on a bogus contempt of court charge for refusing to testify to the Julian Assange grand jury, which I believe has been disbanded. She's now been locked up for 11 months behind that charge, and she owes $230,000 in fines. A new motion placed in court by her lawyers. Over the last decade, Chelsea Manning has shown unwavering resolve in the face of censure, punishment, and even threats of violence. Her resolve not to testify has been unwavering. Her moral conviction has become only more developed since her confinement. Her incarceration is not serving its only permissible purpose. So, we'll see how that goes. But she certainly does deserve to be released, and I consider it obscene that there are no public officials, Democrat or Republican, who speak up for her liberation. Well, we finally have the results from the Afghan election. I think it was held in October. No big surprise. The incumbent, Ashraf Ghani, claims 50.64% of the vote, and his closest rival got 39.5% of the vote. Nevertheless, they continue to wrangle over the election and its outcome. In Libya, the United Nations has urged the warring parties to return to the negotiating table hours after the UN-installed government suspended ceasefire talks in the wake of an attack on Tripoli's port. On Saturday, the forces of Khalifa Haftar shelled the port, killing three people, nearly hitting a ship carrying liquefied gas that would have been a big conflagration had it exploded. So the mess continues, and what is fascinating is that the New York Times has a story about Haftar, Khalifa Haftar. And they reveal new information that we have long suspected, that Khalifa Haftar was a CIA asset recruited back in the Reagan era to run a coup against Gaddafi. The coup never happened, and Haftar settled down just down the road from CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, bought some property, and that property now makes him vulnerable to a U.S. lawsuit because he and his children, his two adult sons, are accused of torture in 2014 during the violence in Libya. But what is fascinating is the rewrite of history engaged in a single sentence by the New York Times. They write, "When a rebellion rose against the Gaddafi government in 2011, prompting the intervention of the United States and NATO, Haftar returned to Libya, building up a powerful faction." But it didn't happen that way. It was the intervention of the U.S. and NATO, fostered by Hillary Clinton, by Samantha Power, by Susan Rice, and accepted begrudgingly by Barack Obama, that led to the rebellion against the Gaddafi government. They have resequenced the events. And that is yellow journalism. Speaking of which, the mainstream media's embrace of the lies about a chemical event in Douma, Libya, back in April of 2018, has led to new evidence that shows that the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons attempted to whitewash and provide a false report blaming the Syrian government for the discharge of chemical weapons, nerve agents. And we know that the inspectors who responded wrote reports that challenged the media narrative that the U.S. had launched, that this was all Syria's fault. And in fact, the inspectors showed that the evidence was placed there to create the perception, the illusion of a chemical event. And it was very clear that that did not happen. So Aaron Maté, writing at the Gray Zone Project, has new evidence, email from an insider at the OPCW, and public evidence from one of the two inspectors who has been vilified by the leadership of the OPCW. It's a great story, and I encourage you to read it when you have a chance. Meanwhile, north of our border, we have twin protests against the construction of a natural gas pipeline in western Canada. The longest blockade is just east of Toronto in a town in Ontario called Tyendinaga. That's a long word. And the other trick word here is that the Mohawk Nation is sponsoring that blockade in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en First Nation of British Columbia. That second tribe has been trying for more than a year to stop the pipeline being laid through part of BC. So 12 days now, the Mohawk blockade, it has affected passenger and freight traffic as well. And Justin Trudeau was trying to be a peacemaker. He said those who would want us to act in haste and want us to boil this down to slogans and ignore the complexities, who think that using force is helpful, it is not. Patience may be in short supply, and that makes it more valuable than ever. But now that there is a second blockade in Alberta near Edmonton, Trudeau has changed his tune. This government is working extremely hard to resolve this situation. We know people are facing shortages, they're facing disruptions, they're facing layoffs. That's unacceptable. We'll see who prevails here. I'm pulling for the First Nations in Canada. And finally today, the State Senate of Utah voted unanimously yesterday to effectively decriminalize polygamy among consenting adults. Now, as you know, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, also known as the Mormons, they have long embraced polygamy. But the state of Utah outlawed it a few years ago, and now in this unanimous vote, as long as it is consensual and not based on fraud, punishments for plural marriage would be limited to fines of up to $750 and community service. I guess that HBO series, Big Love, has softened opposition to polygamy in Utah. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube, and I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.